I've ordered some books, in case anyone is interested, called Touching Our Strength by Carter Hayward. Carter Hayward is a teacher of theology at Boston, and she is also an openly lesbian Episcopalian priest who has been doing a great deal of liberation theology work in a North American context for the last 10 years or so. Our Passion for Justice made a big impact about 5 years ago. Touching Our Strength is hot off the press and is already becoming very influential in the discussions about contemporary theology. I'm not going to follow that chapter by chapter, but if you want to pick it up and read it, you will find themes that I'm going to be talking about, and also feel free to bring any questions that come up while you are reading. In these sessions throughout the week, if you feel like coming back. I just sat through the last half of the Luther lecture and that discussion, and we're going to change gears radically. I'm a baptized Lutheran, and I converted to the United Church of Christ, and I was very much struck by how I am now in a very different personal location than the Lutheran tradition. Over the course of the week, we're going to talk about how liberation theology, specifically feminist theology and gay liberation theologies, are different from traditional or what we call patriarchal theology. And very first on that list is claiming our personal location, so that when you're listening to a patriarchal theologian who would tend to be a straight, white, usually European or North American man, he would skip telling you what his personal location is and assume that everything he says is true for all people. And that's how we've all been grown up. That's a kind of dogmatic approach to theology. We've all benefited a great deal from the traditions that have been handed down to us in that way. At the same time, some huge holes in our perception and understanding of life have come about. So first I want to tell you what my personal location is so that you can integrate that, think about where you're coming from, and that can help us when we come upon conflict to stop and think that perhaps we're coming from 2 different or 5 different or 35 different places, and we don't need to fight each other, we just need to understand each other. I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, the oldest child and first son of a very pious Lutheran family, and I was raised to be a Lutheran pastor. In fact, when my father had the birds and the bees conversation with me in fourth grade, I don't remember what he said about sex, but I remember the end of it all was telling me the story of Samuel and how his parents had given him to the temple and how my parents would be so happy if I would become a pastor. And I grew up being the president of the Luther League and an honor student and an Eagle Scout. And then I went to St. Olaf College and eventually went to Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley. And then when it came time for matriculation, at the end of my second year, I had to come back to Minnesota and have the routine matriculation interview with my bishop, who was Herbert Chilstrom. And I told him that I'm gay. And he presented me with a contract that if I would promise to remain celibate and never tell a congregation I serve that I'm gay, he would support my ordination. My response to that was to claim the Reformation and say, I didn't believe in celibacy. I believed in the goodness of God's creation, and it felt odd to me to be asked to lie in order to be, in order to value my ministry. So I left at that point the Lutheran Church, and it was very painful, because after all, it goes all the way back to the birds and the bees. And I had an identity crisis and ran away to Butte, Montana to be a secular humanist. And my sense of vocation after the healing of a year, and I stopped hating the church, my sense of vocation was still there. And I returned to Berkeley, and I'd gotten out of PLTS with a Master of Theology degree. I went to Pacific School of Religion, which is a sister seminary, as we say, in the GTU in Berkeley, and a United Church of Christ affiliated school from which I got my Master of Divinity degree. I then worked as a hospital chaplain in San Francisco from 82 to 87 on the San Francisco General Hospital AIDS Ward. Then I moved back to Minnesota and was founding pastor of Spirit of the Lakes, which has become the first predominantly gay lesbian church to enter a mainstream denomination, that being the United Church of Christ. And we are 20 months old, and we've gone from 18 people to 700 people. And we've gotten a lot of publicity. If you're from Minnesota, at least, you probably have heard of us. So that's my personal location. And it's a perspective from which I will be presenting and in some cases facilitating our discussion this evening. But I want to claim that up front, that that's the perspective I have. It doesn't need to be your perspective. And when I speak, I'm speaking for myself, not necessarily for God or the church or for you. I'd like to look at what the theological issues are that we most often hear when we talk about gay and lesbian people in the church, whether it's simply being in the church or ordained people. I'd like to start by taking not a political issue or a political approach about gay and lesbian people, but let's take an approach, a theological approach to our Christian faith. Can anyone make a suggestion about what's the central theological idea of Christianity? There is one. Okay. Grace is very Lutheran. How about when it starts with an I? Love is getting close.
Incarnation.
How's that? The Spirit becoming flesh. Or the love of we find love being acted out in the real material world we live in, or other themes that go into this?
Heaven on earth.
No. On earth as it is in heaven, okay? So our ethic is basically an incarnational ethic. Different denominations kind of weigh and balance this differently. We all are aware of Luther calling the Book of James a book of straw. But even Luther would agree that to some extent faith without works is dead. So we need to incarnate what we believe. The story of Jesus is central to our faith because it's God's Spirit or God's love or God's only Son becoming flesh and dwelling among us, full of truth and grace. Do we have consensus? Do we have objections? Now, real often, perhaps most often, we talk about this drama of incarnation in terms of fall redemption as being the central drama of the Bible. Right? Humanity falls into sin. Christ redeems us somehow. I mean, there's that interplay. How many of us were brought up to think about this somehow as sex? Only a non-Lutheran gets in.
All the Catholics do!
But there's more in the Bible, isn't there, than just the fall redemption story? What comes first?
Creation.
What does the Bible say about creation?
Good.
It's good. So what are we trying to be redeemed back to? Good physical creation, right? The flesh is good. What comes after redemption?
Kingdom of God.
Okay.
But now I know that that's the wrong. You can't use kingdom anymore.
For the world.
I'm sorry.
We can use the community of the risen Christ. We can use the new creation, the new heaven and the new earth. We can use revelation. And this is like a, it's, our images tend, even in the Hebrew scripture, tend to be about unnatural things, like the lion laying down with the lamb. Peaceful images of diversity living in peace with justice. That's shalom, the reign of shalom. Peace with justice. So we'll kind of play with this for a while as we go along. But what I wanted to point out, and it feels like we have some sort of consensus here, that the central theme, or certainly a central theme of Christianity, is incarnation, is the Spirit becoming flesh. That happens in the Jesus story, and we are called to follow Christ and do that in our own lives. Now, when I went to, this little Ellis reminded me of Lutheranism. When I went to Lutheran Seminary on the first day, and PLTS is on the West Coast, and it's a very, probably the most international of any of the Lutheran Seminary campuses. There were Lutherans from all over the world. It was the first day. We'd never met each other. We had to go to the required theology class, 101, on day one. And the professor walked in, and he said, and I'll ask you this and see if it still works, what is the cornerstone of Lutheranism? What's the Bible verse that all of Lutheranism is based on? What's your slogan? What are you saved by? Saved by grace. Through faith alone. Right? Do we have consensus on that? Except for gay people.
Where there are other requirements.
Right? I mean, I am not in your official system, I am not, grace is not sufficient for me in your system.
I don't think that's true.
I don't either.
I think that's for all people. We're all sinners.
Right.
It isn't fair to say that Lutherans say that when they don't.
Well, I'm joking. But it's a very serious joke.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. It was a very painful thing in my life, and it still is, that I could not claim this and have my baptism fully recognized through ordination.
Just a moment, I'm sorry. I'm not sure I'm going to say this right.
Mm-hmm.
But what Schulstrom was saying to you was the same thing you say to a heterosexual person. It isn't right for you to have sex until you're married. That's all he was saying to you. And he would say that to a heterosexual person who came as a single person and said, I want to fool around with as many people as I want to, and I don't want to get married. And Schulstrom would have said to the heterosexual person, then we can't ordain you. It's that simple.
Okay.
I think.
So
you explain it to me if it isn't.
Would he marry him to another man then?
Yeah, thank you for
I know Schulstrom is a very spiritual person, a very loving person, and he would be your best friend if you wanted him. I really believe that.
Yeah, I think he's a nice guy too. It becomes very complicated as we move from your statement and my statement and start moving together, and we try to figure this out, and that's what we're going to do this week, okay? What does this mean to you? I mean, to the group? That we're saved by grace through faith alone, not works, lest anyone should boast. It was in the Minnesota papers about a month ago, an exhaustive ecumenical study of 5 years' duration was published that was frightening about 85% of mainstream Protestants don't know what they believe anymore. And this was so drummed into my head that it was hard for me to believe, but at least Lutherans, I thought, knew what they believed. But according to the statistical readout, they don't either. What does this mean to people?
Well, I'm a fairly new Lutheran. I was a Presbyterian before, and it was something kind of odd for me when I first came into the religion that my husband thought that you didn't have to do good works, that you were saved by grace, and I thought that was sort of a cop-out. It sounded sort of Catholic to me. And it took me a long time to sort of buy into that, you know, going to classes and whatnot. Now I think it's wonderful that all you have to do is believe that Christ died for your sins and that you are saved.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's too simplistic.
No, that's by God's grace and your faith.
Right. That becomes real.
First of all, people have to understand what grace, what do you mean by grace? Before you can say you accept that statement.
What is it? What does grace mean to you?
It means an ever-loving God to me, an ever-loving God that loves me just as I am, and that I believe that I have the freedom of His love and to love and show that love to other people. That's what the grace of God means to me.
I totally agree with you. What is that work stuff all about?
I think it's that we can't do anything bad enough or anything good enough to affect God's love. That God's love is there, and that our actions are important and consequential, but not in relation to God's love.
For us.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but if God's going to be there, he's not going to change either for or against us by what we do.
That's a pretty radical thing you just said, isn't it?
I was raised a good Lutheran.
God's love is complete and for us no matter what we do. That's what you said. That's real stern.
It doesn't exclude that we don't have to be accountable for what we do, and we didn't mean that, I know that.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's not that our actions are not significant or important, but that they don't affect how God feels towards us.
But we can, by our actions, separate ourselves from God. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, he's still going to love us, but
so
he's
still
there for our actions.
How about can we, let's start trying to play with combining these two again. We have God's unconditional love for us. Nothing we can do can separate us, you know, that wonderful statement by Paul. Nothing can separate, neither height nor depth, nor principalities nor powers can separate us from the love of God through Christ. However, we're accountable for our actions somehow, and I would assume that's, and we can separate ourselves from God's love. Is the realm of our own actions something to do with our call to incarnate, or what?
I don't think I'm going to exactly respond to your question, but I think my thought when you said how do you put those together in a Lutheran context would be what the Latin for simul justus et peccator, that once you're baptized, you are both saved and still sinner in every dimension of your life, in the church, in your work in the world, in your insides, in your relationships. That's to me where those two come together, is that in that period with the fall redemption, moving toward the kingdom, we're kind of have this notion we're in both of them, sort of got both pieces at once.
Simultaneously saints and sinners. Are there people with Catholic backgrounds who are like confused or anything?
So of the notion that I have to do penance for everything.
It is all sort of a head trip. All this is a reaction to medieval Catholicism, not to be confused with Catholicism today necessarily, in which grace was understood, medieval Catholicism, grace is understood as not as relationship, which is how Luther understood grace, which was a radical new notion, but as a quantity. Grace is a quantity that gets dripped out, and we're all like scales, and we do bad things, and then we do good things. We through penitence, and we get drops of grace to bring it back into balance, our scale back into balance, and hopefully by the time we die, our good side is so we can go to heaven. It's our bad side, we can. If that's too high, then we'll go to hell. And the trick was you never knew where your scale was at. And so Luther, as a very good Catholic monk, was like terrified about his eternal destination. And he started working on this notion of grace and relationship. And instead of, and comes across these passages in the Bible, mostly from Paul, some in the Gospel of John, that really liberate him from this whole religion of fear and this idea that what he called works righteousness, that we, that through little moral acts we work our way to salvation. So this becomes, this is a kind of Reformation slogan that distinguishes it from medieval religion. And in about 1982, the Catholic Lutheran Dialogue came up with a joint statement of like 550,000 words defining grace that kind of brought them together so that we can be an ecumenical dialogue. It's a lot of words. So. Well, what does all this have to do with the Pharisees and Jesus? What do we think of when we think of Pharisees?
Good people who kept the law.
Good people who kept the law. Why did... What was the first thing you thought?
Hypocrites.
Self-righteous.
Me.
Is this personal vocation?
Why did they plot to kill Jesus?
Jesus didn't keep the law.
Pardon?
Jesus didn't keep the law in the same way that they did.
Jesus didn't keep the law.
He blasphemed. Mm. Or they claimed that he blasphemed.
What do you mean? That's kind of a technical word.
But he claimed to be...
God. He didn't keep their laws.
Yeah, no, he made a claim about himself.
No, he said it didn't matter.
The law.
Yeah.
Adiaphora.
He also said it was God.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's the Pharisees who say that he blasphemed. Certainly it's one of the charges at the
right.
time.
Yes.
That he claimed that he did.
I think they said that what bothered them was that he wasn't keeping the law, but it seems to me that probably what bothered them most was he was becoming really popular and, you know, getting the crowds.
So there were probably power and control issues. What did Jesus seem to say about Pharisees and their religion? I mean, there's plenty of quotes we might bring to mind.
Daniel, recorder, and brand.
Okay. Public display of
one is robbing the widows and the poor.
Right.
Their intent was not correct.
Pardon?
Their intent for keeping the law was not correct for the Pharisees.
It was
for their own good, not for their good of all. They kept the letter without having a good heart. They forgot love and keeping the law.
Would you agree that they oppressed people?
Mm-hmm, certainly.
And that Jesus called them on that?
Mm-hmm.
You lay burdens on people and you don't lift one finger to help carry those burdens. Would you imagine that the Pharisees come from a certain class in their society? Was it hard to keep the law? I mean,
if you left both to the town now, but if you left both, you could have gone to
the very good point. There were 632 laws, or 37, by the time of Jesus. And they governed all sorts of, all aspects of people's lives. And the Pharisees were experts in the law, and they were also in control of the system of interpreting law. So your travel actually was a very real situation in which travel was forbidden on the Sabbath because all work was defined as travel. And so the Pharisees defined travel as so many cubits from your home, and you couldn't go any further. And you couldn't do any work yourself. But because they were wealthy enough to hire servants, they would have a servant throw their shoe ahead of them that many cubits. And then, since home was defined as possession, they could go about on their merry way without breaking the law, even though the poor people couldn't do that. Things like that. There were inequities, social injustice going on that Jesus got angry about and said, "Woe to you, Pharisees and hypocrites." Any other ideas about why? In Bible study this morning, we talked about prophets, who was sort of a prophetic figure, right? Calling people to accountability. We talk about Jesus' prophetic ministry as the gospel, the good news, that is somehow defined as different than what went before. So how could we, how do we define the gospel? Last night we heard in the sermon, sometimes we talk too much about the religion of Jesus instead of Jesus' religion. What was Jesus' message? What is the gospel that he preached in the context of Pharisaism? What's the good news?
Freedom from the law.
More radical statement.
Well, is it completely? I'm thinking of the phrase, the law was made for man and not man for the law.
Well, that's a great statement to contemplate. The Sabbath law that I just illustrated with the Pharisees traveling, or that statement comes out of the story, you remember, where the Pharisees are accusing Jesus of breaking the law because he heals on the Sabbath and heals his work. And Jesus says the Sabbath was made for humanity, not humanity for the Sabbath. It's like turning religion upside down. Perhaps we don't, Sabbath isn't a central part of our religious tradition, but the Bible is. Could we draw a parallel there? Like how some people use scripture to oppress or to give comfort and liberation? Yes?
When I think about the Pharisees and others' reactions to Jesus, they both reacted to his proclamation and the way he was living. I mean, I think when he gets up and gives his first public address in Luke 4, says, "I've come to preach good news to the poor, release to the captive, sight to the blind." He's quoting Isaiah. He's right into the Jewish tradition. Everybody goes, "That's wonderful." But then he goes right on to compare that then to the saying, when God looked for prophets, God did not look within the Hebrew people, but for the woman from Samaria. Samaria, at that point, they try and kill him. And then also, he's constantly denounces some of the way the tax collectors, with lepers, with women, with widows, with the poor. It's his actions also that bring about the wrath of people, that combination of the proclamation and the action.
So how would you characterize all those? You just made a list of people that seemed to be who Jesus was associating with instead of the Pharisees.
Outcasts,
the Samaritans, the prostitutes, the lepers, the tax collectors.
For the Pharisees, these were the outcasts. The whole group.
Right. So it seems like Jesus' whole ministry is about these outcast people, as they were defined at their time, vis-a-vis or by the ruling elite, the Pharisees, who controlled religion and the economy. And now we have this conflict going on here that ends in the crucifixion and the resurrection. That somehow this kingdom, somehow this gospel is about these people inheriting the kingdom, right? Not these people. That somehow this freedom from the law that we define gospel as seems to work in pretty well with this saved by grace through faith stuff and not by works of the law.
Except for Pharisees, is that what you're saying?
I think the concept is that Pharisees don't get this.
They don't understand it, or it doesn't apply to them.
They don't understand it. They're missing it somehow.
But he's not applying it to all those people if they continue to do what they do.
I agree with the statement that the Pharisees were good people who kept the law. You know, they were. They were doing their best.
Well, I guess I just don't understand why you're exempting them. If you're saying all those people fall in the category of saved by grace, now you're saying all those people except Pharisees. It's only those people if they understand, and it's a Pharisee if he understands.
Pharisees are saved by grace too, right?
Yes, if they have faith. But they evidently have some kind of disagreement with Jesus because they killed him.
The Pharisees did not kill Jesus.
Oh, who did?
The Romans. Crucifixion is a Roman form of punishment.
Okay.
And I think Jesus was crucified as a possibly seditious element. So I think it's kind of dangerous. I know you're trying to do some valuable comparison here and talk about hypocrisy, but I think it's getting kind of dangerous and anti- Jewish, in a way.
May I be the devil's advocate? As one who is a grant, well, not that my husband says that gives me a standard excuse why I think I'm bad. As one who would be a hellion if I weren't Christian, and sometimes I'm a hellion even when I am a Christian, and as one who's saved by grace through faith, I think the Pharisees have had a bad rap. They were Jews. They knew a one true God. They did not know the Messiah had come. They were willing to keep the laws as much as they understood them from their Old Testament. And they thought that the chosen people were only those who had Jewish blood. It would be awfully difficult for them to accept someone who comes in as Christ did. And Christ's blood was even contaminated by genealogy because he had four Gentile women. So in some sense, there were some Jews who would say he wasn't even Jewish. Because to be a good Jewish boy, you've got to have a Jewish mama. And I think Christ would have thought those Pharisees were saved just like the prostitutes or anyone else, if you want to label sins, although that makes me uncomfortable because I feel like either by thought, desire, or actions that I have sinned in every way that's possible. I don't think you could think of something that I couldn't have somehow identified with. I think it's not because I have low self-esteem. I think it's because I am would a realist be like? I think I see myself as I am. I know I am, and I know what I as a human being is capable of because I've seen what other human beings are capable of through history. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I wonder if a resolution to that would be that Jesus would have invited the Pharisees to the same party as all those other folks. I mean, he was coming into towns and basically declaring feast days. And I guess I would like to think that the Pharisees would have been invited just like all of the other group. Whether they would have chosen to associate with that crowd or not may have been the blocking factor in that was their own choice.
Right. And in fairness, so you know where I'm coming from, I have a Jewish mother and a Jewish brother. My mother married an Orthodox Jew. And so I have learned to love the Jewish people even though they're different than I am, as I would love any other people that are different from mine. I married a Norwegian.
God bless you.
I guess I didn't hear
need
you.
I need to just momentarily respond once again to the to the very healthy and historically true corrective about Pharisees. And emphasize again that I think they were good people and that what we're talking about here is the Christian story that has shaped us and which hopefully we will continue to become more gentle and kind about toward Jewish people as we progress through history. But I think perhaps it's apparent in the kind of direction that I'm trying to facilitate us going. I'm also aware of that we're starting to be out of time. I'd like to pick up on your comment about the feast, inviting everyone to the feast, and way back in the beginning, you said that we're the ones who can put that black between. We're the ones who can choose not to accept God's invitation. So maybe it's about not accepting that invitation. Do we have consensus that these people, the outcasts, are the people of Jesus' ministry in his society? I mean, that's what the gospel is about. Gospel stories tend to be played out in that context. So in the last minutes, the name of this is What Are the Issues? So. I don't know what they are. I don't have any. And I found a church home. So at this point, what are your issues with gay and lesbian people in the church?
I think one issue for us is do we identify gay and lesbian people as, let's say, some of the names you have there, Samaritans, which is a nationality, or lepers, which is a disease, or tax collectors, which is an occupation? What does it mean to people that others are gay and lesbian? Is it a behavior that they see, or is it a sexual orientation? And how does that, what does that mean? Does that mean that that's what that person is by the definition of their being, or that they cannot be that somehow by not having those behaviors?
Right.
Is it clear what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. So the question is sin and whether or not we're repentant. And in order for it to be sin, by definition, it has to be a choice. So a central question is the psychological, sociological question. Are gay and lesbian people a primary category of human being, like race and left-handedness and gender? Or are we fallen away heterosexuals who choose to do this behavior even though so much abuse is heaped upon us?
Or even if it's not a choice, is it a sickness that needs to be healed?
Right.
There are a lot of different ways of looking at it.
And how does it fit into this? You know, our bodies, are our bodies bad? Except so bad that we have to restrict that in a very limiting way. So I think this is a kind of central issue, and it also goes back up to here. Do we believe gay and lesbian people, or do we believe non-gay and lesbian people who define us? I think that's really related to this central issue down here. If gay and lesbian people are telling the church, this is not a choice, and we don't feel it's not about sin, that sin comes down the road here. Sin is not our orientation, it's what we do with our orientation. If gay and lesbian people are saying that, that's one authoritative source. And then if non-gay people are saying, no, that's not true, this is who you are, that becomes there's a question of authority here, too.
I think one of the authority pieces, I think it's a symptom, not a root issue, is our biblical injunction things. Sort of, are you, I guess for want of a better word, the slippery slope questions. As I say, I think that's more a symptom related to personal location discussion.
Right.
I think that for a lot of people, that's the place where you feel it. You know, if you're not in the position where you're feeling the pain of it, if you're sort of trying to think about it, it's a hard one.
And tomorrow we're going to focus a little more on feminist theology and how that fits into this bigger circle. And we're going to use as a case study all the Bible verses that say women are less than men, women should be silent in the church. And how did the Lutheran Church, the Scandinavian part of the Lutheran Church, come to the point where you dare to defy scriptural authority? Why is it okay for women but not for gay and lesbian people? Why do we not take the 12 verses in the New Testament that say slaves remain subject to your masters? How come that's not literally true when other verses are? How do we decide which verses in the Bible are literally true and which ones aren't? And what is the relationship between the authority of Scripture and the authority of personal experience, which is a real hot debate in the Christian church now? It's kind of a new reformation happening, and a real interesting thing to talk about. Any other issues?
Related to that, I'd say when you're looking at the gospel or scripture, you got to ask the question, if Jesus were here today, how would he be ministering to the gay and lesbian community, and what would he be saying today about that? And that's I mean, that, the answer to me is obvious, but I think it's something that we need to kick around. What kind of reality would that be like today if Jesus were here in this situation?
Okay. Where's Christ's presence today in this situation? And how do we discern that?
I think that, do you want to push it in a little bit different direction? One of the things that I hear people, it's not coming right out and saying, it's sort of hinting around about is, well, why can't we just be quiet about this? You know, these people have been in our congregation forever and they were quiet before. Now, why do we have to make a big deal now? So that there's a sort of benign neglect. Why can't we go back to benign neglect? Why do we have to talk about this? Which goes the other end of the spectrum from, is this a sin, to, is this something we should celebrate? Is this something we should be happy about? You see what I'm saying, Dan?
Yeah, I'm trying to, how can we make that a little tighter?
Oh.
Are we celebrating it, or are we just at this?
Yeah, are we just
facing
it? Is this just toleration, you know, is this just toleration, or is it something to embrace and celebrate?
Well, to me, one of the basic problems is, what does God say about man and woman in relationship, and created man and woman, and how to look at the whole problem? Are you familiar with Leanne Payne's book, The Broken Image?
No.
Well, she deals with this whole problem of homosexuality and lesbian. She says there's behavioralist and the psychological interpretation, there's a spiritual interpretation. And she maintains, and there are enough studies, that this is a case where it requires inner healing, where something went amiss, like there can be in other areas, and it's something that can be healed. So one is not born a lesbian or born gay, and there's nothing you can do about it. But it happens because of some trauma in life. And that needs healing. And I would say that Jesus today, he is always for wholeness and always for life. He would say, do you want to be well? Do you want to be healed? And that's a crucial question.
Yeah, it hits several of us. It's like, how do we interpret the Bible in terms of what you're saying? Is the woman who's the authority you're citing a lesbian? Or is she a heterosexual defining me? And do I feel unwhole? Do I feel separated from my God? And since I don't, how can we talk about that? Because with all due respect, can't agree with that perspective, and I'm living it, so what can we do about that?
Well, that comes a matter of choice. You know, if you're happy with who you are, that's fine. That's your business. But I think it's dangerous to say, to sanction it and say the Bible sanctions it. I think that's a basic issue, and we have some theologians here, they haven't said anything. I'm not a theologian, but I've been concerned about this issue because I'm in counseling and I know people, and I don't take it lightly.
Neither do I. It's a very serious problem in our society. Homophobia kills people, and people suffer because of it. And so, you know, and the Bible sanctions many things. The Bible sanctions Solomon having 500 wives and 500 concubines. And you don't use that as a sexual ethic for our society today. So
it doesn't say that it sanctions it. I mean, it showed problems that there were, but I mean, if you talk about what the Bible sanctions, we have to have another session on that.
Right.
I think that kind of gets at what the woman up there brought up, though, which is, how far is the church called to go on the spectrum of intolerance to tolerance to acceptance to affirmation and celebration. That there's a lot of stopping places. And how far is the church called to go on that spectrum?
I think the whole issue of homophobia is a central issue here. You cannot have been raised in this culture and not have been impacted by racist, sexist, homophobic, other dynamics like that, and however you have felt in the freedom of Christ, freed from that, you still have, as a white male, I certainly have a lot of issues to deal with in all of these areas, hopefully in a continuing recovery and growth in grace, pardon the Lutheran expression. But I also, under that vestige or under that area of homophobia, I want to make sure that a personal location for me is a little bit of a discomfort in suggesting that if I ask questions that it's coming out of a homophobic.
Oh yeah.
Okay, and I would hope that, you know, as questions are raised here, that assumption would be made about me. You can make about the rest of them, but I don't I'll be glad to let you know if that's one of my issues, and I would hope I would identify that way.
Yeah, and please, I mean, give me some grace in terms
Absolutely.
Of...
Absolutely.
We have huge things to cover in a mass audience, and so there's generalizations. But as you feel free to talk with me and the other gay and lesbian people who are guests this week, and one of the things, and don't be afraid of like stupid questions, because one of the really graceful things about our situation is that gay and lesbian people grow up in the same society as straight people, and so we all have those same assumptions, only there's an internal motivation or a spiritual push of integrity that forces us to break out of those. So we've gone through the same process that you, wherever you are in your process, are going, and we're not like judgmental about that for the most part, because we've been there. We can relate. Well, I didn't know if there were, I thought maybe there would be three people here. So this has been great, and I hope that you come back and we can talk some more through the week and talk with each other during the day. And I'll end by saying that this is what saved my life, and through my struggle of coming out as a gay person of good health and self-esteem, I credit my Lutheran upbringing, that I'm saved by grace through faith alone. And that's not just a dogma to fight over, that's about mental health in all sorts of ways. And that's worth claiming. So, peace. See you later.